January 7th. The storm is over, and it's one of those beautiful winter mornings when a vapor is seen hanging in the air between the village and the woods. Though the snow is only some 6 inches deep, the yards appear full of those beautiful crystals, star or wheel-shaped flakes, lying light as a measure is full of grain.
The words you have just heard are from the Journal of Henry David Thoreau. This program is Americana, the 11th in a series of radio essays on the American scene, presented each week by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Tonight we bring you Winter Scene.
Good evening. I'm Martin Maloney of the School of Speech at Northwestern University. Some few weeks ago in this series, Bill Grisky read you a short passage from Thoreau's Walden. And within the next week, I had two or three notes from people who had listened asking why we didn't do a complete program on Thoreau. Well, there was no reason why we should not, and all sorts of reasons why we should. This year is the 100th anniversary of Walden. I've just been reading William Condrey's admirable short biography of Thoreau and working my way through the Viking Press's portable Thoreau. And in any event, I can think of no one better to talk about during the winter months than the great observer of Walden Pond. Surely no one in this country has ever had a better eye for the natural history of winter.
Very little evidence of God or man did I see just then. And life not as rich and inviting an enterprise as it should be, when my attention was caught by a snowflake on my coat sleeve. It was one of those perfect crystalline star-shaped ones, six-rayed, like a flat wheel with six spokes. Only the spokes were perfect little pine trees in shape, arranged around a central spangle. This little object, which with many of its fellows rested unmelting on my coat, so perfect and beautiful, reminded me that nature had not lost her pristine vigor yet, and why should man lose heart? These little wheels came down like the wrecks of chariots from a battle waged in the sky. There were mingled with these starry flakes small downy pellets. This was mid-afternoon, and it has not quite ceased snowing yet at 10 p.m. We are rained and snowed on by gems. What a world we live in. Where are the jeweler's shops? There is nothing handsomer than a snowflake and a dewdrop. I may say that the maker of the world exhausts his skill with each snowflake and dewdrop that he sends down. We think that the one mechanically coheres and that the other simply flows together and falls. But in truth, they are the product of enthusiasm, the children of an ecstasy, finished with the artist's utmost skill. January 7th. The storm is over. And it is one of those beautiful winter mornings when a vapor is seen hanging in the air between the village and the woods. Though the snow is only some 6 inches deep, the yards appear full of those beautiful crystals, star or wheel-shaped flakes, lying light as a measure is full of grain.
This was from Thoreau's journal, the year 1858. It occurred to me a few days ago, as I was making notes for the script of this program, that perhaps we should get Clint Yule to do a special weather forecast for Christmas evening before we decided whether to do this script or not. In a way, it would be a pity to remind you of Thoreau's clear, cold, ice-brittle winter world on one of those dun-colored, foggy days of the Chicago winter. Still on second thought, the weather forecast at best would assure us of nothing. The world of Walden, I fear, is gone forever. Where shall we see now the ice cutters of Walden Pond?
While yet it is cold January and the snow and ice are thick and solid, the prudent landlord comes from the village to get ice to cool his summer drink. Impressively, even pathetically wise to foresee the heat and thirst of July, now in January, wearing a thick coat and mittens, when so many things are not provided for. It may be that he lays up no treasures in this world which will cool his summer drink in the next. He cuts and saws the solid pond, unroofs the house of fishes, and carts off their very element and air, held fast by chains and stakes like corded wood, through the favoring winter air to wintry cellars, to underlie the summer there. It looks like solidified azure, as far off it is drawn through the streets. The ice cutters are a merry race, full of jest and sport, and when I went among them, they were wont to invite me to saw pit fashion with them, I standing underneath. Thus, for 16 days, I saw from my window 100 men at work like busy husbandmen, with teams and horses, and apparently all the implements of farming. Such a picture as we see on the first page of the almanac. And as often as I looked out, I was reminded of the fable of the lark and the reapers, of the parable of the sower and the light. And now they are all gone. And in 30 days more, probably, I shall look from the same window on the pure sea-green Walden water there, reflecting the clouds and the trees, and sending up its evaporations in solitude. And no traces will appear that a man has ever stood there. Perhaps I shall hear a solitary loon laugh as he dives and plumes himself, or shall see a lonely fisher in his boat like a floating leaf, beholding his form reflected in the waves, where lately 100 men securely labored.
You will see from this, I'm sure, why I feel that no possible twist or turn of the weather could recreate Thoreau's Massachusetts scene for you. For there's time in this picture. Time quite as much as weather and earth. Time that's gone as surely as the ice cutters from the surface of the spring-thawed pond. Thoreau's life is worth study, even as his work is. In this connection, let me recommend to you William Condrey's short and pleasantly written biography, which was published this year by the Philosophical Library. And I should mention to you again the Portable Thoreau, one of the excellent series of portable volumes published by the Viking Press, which contains the complete text of Walden, together with generous selections from most of Thoreau's other works and a very good critical introduction to Thoreau by the editor, Carl Bode. Thoreau was, in his way, a strange man. Of course, most writers are. You know, I suppose that all writers of any consequence are people with insoluble problems. If you had no problems, what would you write about? And if you were able to solve them, why should you not stop writing? What Thoreau's problems were, it's rather difficult to say. But it's clear enough that he tried to solve them in two ways. By a consistent withdrawal from and sometimes attack upon human society, and by exposing himself to the most intimate contact with nature. All this, of course, you'll find in his writings. On the one hand, the great essay on civil disobedience, and on the other, Walden. Thoreau was born on the outskirts of Concord, Massachusetts, on July 12, 1817. His father, John Thoreau, was one of those businessmen who seem to have been peculiarly common in New England during the last century, sort of man who inherits a good deal of money, works hard, shows great enterprise in trade, and somehow contrives, by great effort, to come closer year by year to bankruptcy. Young Henry attended the academy at Concord, went to Harvard on a scholarship, graduated without any special distinction, and came home to Concord, which was quite an exciting town in those days.
The atmosphere of the late 30s was one of optimism and revolt. There was a general current of belief, in the younger circles at least, that a new type of man was evolving, a man of heroism, self-sufficiency, and sensibility. Emerson inspired his audience with the excitement of taking part in a renaissance in which the human mind was about to step up to a higher plane of understanding. No one word was found which could do justice to the many original trends of thought. In New England, you spoke simply of the newness, and everyone knew that you meant that intriguing aura of philosophical novelties chiefly associated with the name of Ralph Waldo Emerson. So when in 1837, the 20-year-old Henry Thoreau, graduate, walked home from college to Concord, it was no ordinary moment in the history of Western progress. And Concord was no ordinary village to return to in 1836, for Emerson had now been living there for 3 years.
Thoreau's term of years at Harvard had prepared him for acceptance into the Emerson circle. Making a living, that was something else. He tried teaching at the village school, but had to quit because he couldn't bear to whip his pupils, a standard pedagogical technique in those days. Later, he and his brother opened an academy at Concord and had a modest success. But his brother fell ill of tuberculosis, and in 1841, Henry closed the academy with a considerable sense of relief. As Condry suggests, he was not a man who supported responsibilities well.
I am freer than any planet. I can move away from public opinion, from government, from religion, from education, from society. Thank fortune, we are not rooted to the soil, and here is not all the world. If you are chosen town clerk, forsooth, you cannot go to Tierra del Fuego this summer.
But there's not much point in rehearsing the full story of Thoreau's fiscal problems here. The fact is that he never contrived to solve them too satisfactorily. Or perhaps it would be fairer to say that he solved them by learning to live on nothing. Emerson provided him with a job of sorts as a caretaker, and during this period he began to write, and to write very well. But there was no living in it. When his first book, A Week on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers, was published, it was issued in an edition of 1,000 copies. Over a period of several years, not quite 300 copies were sold. The other 700, the publishers handed over to Thoreau. It was at this point that he remarked,
I have a library of 900 volumes, over 700 of which I have written myself.
Condry describes admirably his situation at the end of his stay with the Emersons.
Though the 2 years at the Emersons had brought Thoreau a promise of literary success, there was clearly no hope of his making a reasonable living by writing, unless, like Emerson, he could turn his ideas into popular lectures and books. He had begun to lecture, but no farther afield than Concord. Perhaps someday he would be famous, but meanwhile, how to live? He had still to work out a fixed purpose and a more positive view of life when his sojourn with the Emersons came to an end. Now, he made a thrust toward the only goal he had in view, the goal of writing and lecturing for a living. Once more, Emerson was at hand with ready help. He sent Thoreau to Staten Island near New York to be tutor to the son of William Emerson, his elder brother. And Henry would be near the New York publishing and writing world and would have a far better chance to making good. He made friends. He learned a great deal. Learned a great deal about journalism, publishing, Fuhrerism, individualism, but he failed. He discovered that there was little hope of making a living as a writer in New York unless you were prepared to turn out rubbish for the popular magazines. Even in those days, women's papers paid well. He reported, they say there is a lady's companion that pays, but I could not write anything companionable.
No, companionable writing, unless it reflected companionship with the beast and the wild men of his woods, was clearly beyond Thoreau. Humanity was not for him. Carl Bode, editor of the Portable Thoreau, makes clear the writer's instinctive retreat from human contacts by describing the events of a day in 1860.
Sometime before the end of this fourth day of November 1860, he sat down to write a letter. It went to Daniel Ricketson, New Bedford Quaker, and one of Thoreau's greatest admirers. The year Walden came out, Ricketson had written Thoreau a long epistle of praise for the books. He had added a pen picture of himself, a description of his shanty that likened it to the hut at Walden Pond, and an invitation for Thoreau to visit him. Thoreau had answered, although a little tardily, and so a correspondence had ensued. Visits were exchanged, and in spite of clear conflicts of temperament in the two writers, a friendship developed that showed itself for 4.5 years. And then, so far as Thoreau was concerned, the friendship stopped, or that at least was what Daniel Ricketson thought. He continued to write Thoreau, and he filled his letter with invitations and reproaches. Ricketson's hurt feelings showed themselves increasingly. He complained about Thoreau's neglect. Why didn't Thoreau write? Why didn't he visit New Bedford again? Thoreau must be cold and antisocial, indifferent to his obligations toward fellow men. Well, finally, after Ricketson had besieged him with prose and verse for 1.5 years, the Concord man replied. He turned on Ricketson with a hard explicitness. The letter of November 4, 1860, begins politely enough with Thoreau's thanks for the laudatory verses that Ricketson sent, but after that, Thoreau breaks out.
Why would you waste so many regards on me and not know what to think of my silence? Infer from it what you might from the silence of a dense pine wood. My silence is just as inhuman as that, and no more. You know that I never promised to correspond with you, and so, when I do more than I promised.
Such are his habits and pursuits, Thoreau continues, that he rarely goes abroad. He's enjoyed his visits with Ricketson, regrets that he cannot enjoy them more often, but after this concession, he repels Ricketson again and says flatly,
"Life is short. And there are other things to be done. I admit that you are more social than I am, and far more attentive to the common courtesies of life. But this is partly because you have fewer or less exacting private habits."
And such was Henry Thoreau's last notable battle in the major war of his life. The war to repel any and all invasions of his vitally essential privacy. He needed privacy. He needed privacy to walk, to think, to write. He had found out long ago in the broadest, most basic terms, Thoreau was a man alone.
If this was Thoreau's attitude toward a single individual who pressed him over hard with friendliness, you can imagine how he felt toward society, toward governments and institutions whose advances on the individual are rarely very warm. I suppose everyone knows the story of Thoreau's police record. The fact is that he made something of a point of not paying his poll tax, and as a result, he was arrested one summer evening in Concord and lodged in the village jail. He was released the following morning. Someone had paid the tax for him. It was not really a very horrendous experience, but on a man of Thoreau's principles and rather uneventful life, it was bound to have a considerable effect. He described the experience much later when he wrote Civil Disobedience.
I have paid no poll tax for 6 years. I was put into a jail once on this account for one night, and as I stood considering the walls of solid stone 2 or 3 feet thick and the iron grating which strained the light, I couldn't help being struck with the foolishness of that institution which treated me as if I were mere flesh and blood and bones to be locked up. I saw that if there was a wall of stone between me and my townsmen, there was a still more difficult one to climb or break through before they could get to be as free as I was. As they could not reach me, they had resolved to punish my body, just as boys, if they cannot come at some person against whom they have a spite, will abuse his dog. I saw that the state was half-witted, that it was timid as a lone woman with her silver spoons, and that it didn't know its friends from its foes. and I lost all my remaining respect for it, and I pitied it. Thus the state never intentionally confronts a man's sense, intellectual or moral, but only his body, his senses. It is not armed with superior wit or honesty, but with superior physical strength. I was not born to be forced. I will breathe after my own fashion. If a plant cannot live according to its nature, it dies. And so does man.
The essay on civil disobedience is well worth reading if you've never read it, and well worth your further careful study if you have. It's one of the world's great libertarian documents, and it's never made such pointed reading as now, when individual independence has become for many a luxury and not a manner of breathing after my own fashion. Thoreau's essay has had its historic consequences, too, for a man named Gandhi read it and was inspired by it one time when he was in jail. You can imagine Gandhi, I'm sure, reading these lines.
Under a government which imprisons any unjustly, the true place for a just man is also in prison. The proper place today, the only place which Massachusetts has provided for her freer and less desponding spirits, is in her prisons. To be put out and locked out of the state by her own act, as they've already put themselves out by their principles. It's there that the fugitive slave and the Mexican prisoner on parole and the Indian come to plead the wrongs of his race should find them on that separate but more free and honorable ground where the state places those who are not with her but against her. The only house in a slave state and which a free man can abide with honor. If any think that their influence should be lost there, and their voices no longer afflict the ear of the state, they do not know by how much truth is stronger than error, nor how much more eloquently and effectively he can combat injustice who has experienced a little in his own person. Cast your whole vote, not a strip of paper merely, but your whole influence. A minority is powerless when it conforms to the majority. It is not even a minority then, but it is irresistible when it clogs by its whole weight.
Thoreau was, I suppose, a philosophical anarchist, or at least that label fits him as well as any. But perhaps you will think this a large title for a man who, in the last analysis, merely wanted to be left alone, who didn't really like to be around people. Of course, that's the way with philosophies and with poetry. Trace them back a little way, and you reduce the greatest systems and the most dazzling truths to trivial human irritations and ills of the sort that produce from most of us only a few feeble and irritable complaints. Well, perhaps you'll want to know what became of this most rugged of individualists. Indeed, nothing very much became of him as far as external episodes go. The story of his life, if it could be told only in terms of dramatic incidents and adventure, would be considerably shorter and simpler than that of the life of Solomon Grundy. He lived on for a time, botanizing and writing and lecturing. He came to be, it should surprise nobody, less and less friendly with his old friend Emerson. He took a good deal of pleasure in violating the Fugitive Slave Act. And when John Brown was executed for treason and murder, Thoreau proclaimed him a martyr. It seems to have been Brown's effort to settle the slavery issue single-handed which appealed to Thoreau. The ensuing war between two governments didn't interest him. In the long run, as most people do, he fell fatally ill. His ruggedness was more spiritual than physical at best. He returned to Concord from a long trip into Minnesota, very ill, late in 1861.
Thoreau, most quotable of men, remained so to the last. Some of his deathbed remarks endorsing his independent life have become famous. To an old acquaintance concerned about his welfare and the life beyond the grave, Thoreau replied softly,
"My friend, one word at a time."
To Aunt Maria, anxious whether he had made his peace with God, he replied that he had never quarreled with him. His old friend of the village jailer, Sam Staples, who had once robbed him of a night at Walden and thus occasioned one of his great pieces of writing, visited him and came away saying that he had never seen a man dying with so much pleasure and peace. He lingered a whole winter and died when spring was at its height. It was the 6th of May, 1862.
It is, in a sense, a happy thought that Thoreau best eased his pain when he wrote of the seasons and the earth, and especially, I insist, of winter. To be sure, there are summers in Massachusetts and even springs, but they are not the solitary season. And it was that which Thoreau loved, the aloneness, the warm solitude of winter.
Though winter is represented in the almanac as an old man, facing the wind and sleet, and drawing his cloak about him, we rather think of him as a merry woodchopper and a warm-blooded youth, as blithe as summer. The unexplored grandeur of the storm keeps up the spirits of the traveler. It does not trifle with us, but there's a sweet earnestness. In winter, we lead a more inward life. Our hearts are warm and cheery, like cottages under drifts whose windows and doors are half concealed, but from whose chimneys the smoke cheerfully ascends. The imprisoning drifts increase the sense of comfort which the house affords, and in the coldest days we are content to sit over the hearth and see the sky through the chimney top, enjoying the quiet and serene life that may be had in a warm corner by the chimney side, or feeling our pulse by listening to the low of cattle in the street, or the sound of a flail in distant barns all long afternoon. No doubt a skillful physician could determine our health by observing how these simple and natural sounds affect us. We enjoy now not an oriental, but a boreal leisure, around warm stoves and fireplaces, and watch the shadow of motes in the sunbeams.
You have been listening to Americana, the 11th in a series of radio essays dealing with American history and American living, presented each week by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Americana is written and narrated by Martin Maloney. Direction is by Ralph Noe. Music supervision by Maury Streetmatter. Audio engineering by Ed Goff. Turntable operation by Harry Budinger. The quoted materials were read by myself, Bill Grisky. The books mentioned on tonight's program were The Portable Thoreau, edited by Carl Bodie and published by the Viking Press, and William Condrey's Thoreau, published by the Philosophical Library. If you wish to receive a list of the books discussed on this program, please send your name and address on a postcard to Americana, care of the School of Speech, Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois, and a free copy will be sent to you. This is NBC Radio.